Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
And can I just say, I'm in like that weird dream. I don't even know if it's dream, like that weird, almost trance, uncomfortable, but good feeling where you get no sleep and then you overcompensate with way too much caffeine. So you are both like exhausted and wide awake at the exact same time. And that is where I am this week.
That sounds horrible. I'm sorry that you're feeling like that.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. Like, I was driving over to do the show and I was on the road and I was like, I'm so awake and I'm so tired. It's like jittery, but also like I could fall asleep right now. So I don't know. That's how I'm feeling this week. So I guess it's good that Beth is actually doing most of the talking this week. Otherwise,
well, the
I'm
hope is
talk
that
nonsense.
Beth did all the research and has the stories this week, but hopefully we both have stuff to talk about.
Yes.
Yeah. Like,
but
Amelia's
it's good
all
you're giving the information.
Amelia's all super jittery. But no, you know how there's always fun parts in these stories that, you know, we just have to talk about a little bit, right?
Yes.
Okay. This week.
Glasta.
Could we please get Matt Damon, please come on our show and say Gloucester. Ben Affleck, we would take you as a second choice, but Matt Damon. Any day of the week. All right. The self-proclaimed America's oldest seaport. Longtime listeners of the show might have an inkling that one, Amelia is deathly allergic to the ocean and won't go near it. And two, Beth is obsessed with the ocean and with boating. So if we extrapolate out from there, Beth is doing an episode on a haunted seaport, right? With the boats and everything. And Amelia did an episode on vampires. So there must be some connection here between Amelia being allergic to the ocean and Beth being allergic to vampires.
Ba-dum-ching.
You decide. All right. Can we talk really quick about sailing and boating superstitions? Because sailors are notoriously superstitious. And they're superstitious about weird stuff. So I have shamelessly stolen these top 20 maritime superstitions from maritimemuseum.co.nz, which is New Zealand's maritime museum website. So going through them, the first superstition that sailors have is about renaming a boat. It's bad luck to change the name of the boat. And if you do, you must have a denaming ceremony and officially christen the boat again. So you have to smash the champagne bottle on the boat again. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. No, I had no idea.
I knew that it was bad luck to rename a boat once it gets its name, like that's it. But I never heard that you could have a denaming ceremony.
When you name a boat the first time, do you smash champagne on it?
Yep.
Do you know why that is?
Good luck. It's the christening ceremony.
Okay. Cool.
I remember going to one over at the Four River Bridge when we were kids. It was one of the last ships that they sent out from the Quincy Shipyard. And we went and it was a lady. She was in a blue dress and she had a bottle and she smashed it. It was kind of cool.
Cool.
All right. The next thing is about tattoos. All right. So when tattooing became popular at sea, a rooster and a pig were often tattooed onto sailors' feet. It was believed these animals would prevent the sailors from drowning by showing them the way to shore. I have never considered roosters or pigs to be particularly directionally gifted, but why not?
Yeah, that's funny. So I have a swallow on my foot. Mm-hmm. And the reason I have that is because swallows go very far out to sea, but not so far they can't go back. So I like that because it's kind of the idea. My parents are birders. I like the idea of going far away from home, but not too far you can't come home. But also, I was reading when I first got my tattoo that sailors, they would know they're kind of close when they saw swallows in the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, your swallow on your foot, I think, makes slightly more sense than a rooster and a pig. But
I'm wondering where the heck a pig came from.
Yeah, I don't know. I could probably look more into that, but I was just kind of going through the superstitions themselves. All right. Next one, blood. It is unlucky to set off at the start of the fishing season without having first shed some blood in a fight or in an accident. I don't care for that one. Next up is fishing nets. When sailors are setting fishing nets, when fishermen set the fishing nets, it is good luck to use an odd number of nets. And that's another one that I'm like, huh, what an interesting idea. That to set out three is better than two or four. Call. Having the call of a newborn child on ship was meant to prevent anyone from drowning. This meant that calls were often purchased by sailors before a voyage. Do you know what a call is? C-A-U-L. I didn't either, and it's actually horrifying. A call is a harmless membrane that covers the face and head of a newborn baby. It is very rare. So they would want to bring like the, basically like the, almost like the amniotic sac, right? That the baby is in, but there's like this little membrane, I guess, over their face and like, no, thank you. Next up is a hat overboard. Losing a hat overboard was an omen that the trip would be a long one. Now, as a sailor, I have lost many, many a hat that just blew right off my head out into the ocean. And the number one rule on the boat is we're there to have fun. The number two rule on the boat is if your hat falls off, forget it. You're not getting it back. All right, eggshells. Eggshells are the next superstition. Eggshells had to be broken into tiny pieces once an egg was cracked open. And this was meant to stop witches coming to the ship to sail in the pieces of shell. Apparently witches, so if you just had like the two halves of the shell, apparently a witch can like steal her way into one of those and be on the ship hitching a ride. Yeah. Yeah, that's a little creepy.
Like a little witch, like a little Tinkerbell.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe witches and fairies are the same thing in seafaring lore. All right. Personal grooming superstition. Anyone aboard who trimmed their nails, cut their hair, or shaved their beard brought bad luck to the ship.
Oh, interesting. So that's why everyone was kind of shaggy.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't
long
know that.
Hair, beards.
I thought it was just like a bunch of dudes together. Like,
yeah. That's kind of what I thought too. That they were like, you know, there's no women around. We don't really care what we look or smell like. Right?
Yeah.
All right. Feet superstition. Flat-footed people were unlucky on board a ship and were also avoided by sailors before they boarded. Do you know anybody flat-footed?
I do, yeah. None of them sail. I'm wondering, I'm like playing with my feet or moving around under. And I'm wondering, do you think it's just because you can't like get a grip with your feet?
I don't think so.
I would be very lucky because I have unusually high arches.
Well, my dad had flat feet. And he was notoriously bad luck with boats.
Interesting.
He loved boats, but it was like everything that he tried to do with them, you know, like he bought a boat and he managed to somehow like put a hole in it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Like it was like that sort of stuff. He was a flat-footed person and apparently he was unlucky on ships. Women. Women were bad luck on board because they distracted the crew, which would anger the sea, causing treacherous conditions as revenge.
I've heard this one before.
However, conveniently for the male crew, naked women calmed the sea, which is why so many figureheads were women with bare boobs.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, but nowadays we have lots of very competent and, you know, well-respected women sailors. Apparently that one is on the way out. All right, next up, non-sailing days. It was bad luck to sail on Thursdays, because that's Thor's day, the god of storms, or Friday, the day Jesus was executed, the first Monday in April, because that's the day that Cain killed Abel, the second Monday in August, the day Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, and December 31st, which is the day on which Judas Iscariot hanged himself. So it's interesting that Thursday, Thor's day, and Thor was a Norse god, right? So you can't sail on Thursdays. And then the rest of them are all Christian-based holidays or non-sailing days. So I thought that was very interesting. Yeah. Okay. Next up, watch your mouth. Some words and sayings brought about bad luck on board, including drowned, goodbye, and good luck. Things to do with the land were believed to be bad luck, if mentioned, such as church, a pig, fox, cat, or rabbit. And interestingly enough, you can't talk about a pig, but you can have one tattooed on your foot.
Yeah, that's weird. And didn't all the ships, at least like pirate ships, always had cats on them?
Did they?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was probably to eat all the rats.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. All right. No whistling. I feel like whistling is a thing that definitely should not have happened at all. Amelia's pointing her finger at me.
Because I wanted to say something. And that is a superstition in my house because my fiance is Russian. And Russian superstition says no whistling inside of any kind or you'll go broke.
Or you go broke?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, in maritime superstition, whistling or singing into the wind was forbidden as it would whistle up a storm. So, yeah, interesting. All right. No farewell. It was bad luck for seafaring men's wives to call them out or wave goodbye once they stepped out the door to leave for a voyage. So I think it's up there with like break a leg in show business that you just find something else to say in place of good luck or farewell. Right. All right. Number six, stirring tea. Stirring tea with a knife or fork would invite bad luck. Yeah, I'm not sure why. Because I imagine that they didn't have like a lot of sugar or milk or anything that they were putting in their tea. So why would they have needed to stir it?
So I stir my tea. I drink my tea black, but I stir for two reasons. The first reason I stir is to cool it.
Okay.
So maybe they were just trying to like cool their tea down.
Okay.
The second, I guess it's not related. It just reminded me is because when I do tassiomancy, tea leaf reading,
mm-hmm.
the superstition is that you have to stir. It's like a certain amount of times in a certain direction. So I'm wondering if that could be related. At like maybe it's some like spooky aunt witch thing that kind of just like happened over time.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I'm noticing that it doesn't say that you can't stir with a spoon. It's only with a knife or fork. So I don't know. All right. Next up, turning a loaf of bread upside down. Turning a loaf of bread upside down once it had been cut brings bad luck too. Redheads. Like flat-footed people, redheads were believed to bring you bad luck on a ship. If you met one before boarding, the only way to mitigate the bad luck was to speak to them before they could speak to you. So apparently, if you see a redhead before you get on a boat, you better run up and say something. Don't let them talk to you first. All right, number three. These are the last three. Salt. It was bad luck for one crewman to pass the salt pot to another directly. Presumably one could put it down and the other one could pick it up, but you can't like hand it one to the other. Number two, fishy. In order to encourage fish to be caught, fishermen would begin their fishing session by throwing one of the crew members overboard and then hauling him back on, like modeling for the fish what they wanted to happen.
Okay.
I thought this one was pretty funny. Oh, all right. And the last one, which I can completely get behind, no bananas on board. They were believed to be so unlucky they would cause the ship to be lost. Whole cargoes of bananas were especially frightening for sailors. Personally, I don't like bananas. I would be just as happy for them to not exist at all.
I really like bananas. I'm wondering why that would be a thing. I have a theory. Do you want to hear my theory? So I know this. I'm not going to get into why I know this, but bananas, when they start to go bad, are prime mating ground for flies. And what will happen when they really start to go is flies will lay eggs throughout the interior of the banana,
mm-hmm.
and then maggots will crawl out. So if you have a case of bananas, it's like the most perfect breeding ground for insects.
Yeah, that's gross.
It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Yeah. But I imagine that's probably why. And I was also thinking about the salt one. And my thought with that, and I could be wrong, but back, people don't do this anymore because, I don't know, people don't really drink hot coffee as much as they used to. But back when, you know, I started being a barista in cafes, you couldn't hand a coffee to a customer. You had to put it down and the customer had to pick it up. And that is so nothing spilt or fell out because it was more likely to drop with a handoff. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if that was the same kind of idea with salt. Because wasn't salt like fairly expensive at that time?
I would think so.
Like kind of expensive, probably harder to come by than it is now. I mean, you couldn't just like go to the store and pick some up.
Right. We have to have salt for our bodies. So it's like an essential on the boat that people would have to have it. We don't need sugar. We don't need, you know, some of us need coffee, but, you know.
Especially today.
But we don't necessarily need coffee. But yeah, salt is one of those things that, like, you have to have it or your body will not work properly. Mm-hmm. So could be that. I would be interested to know if it was the same thing for, like, lemons or limes, right? Because they used to take those once they figured out that sucking on a lemon once a week would keep scurvy away. So whatever.
Yeah, but if you pass a lemon and you drop it, you can still use it. But if, like, the salt fell on the floor, probably just
it's gone. Weird. Weird superstitions, yeah?
Yeah.
All right. But since fishing is an ancient tradition, we can certainly agree to disagree on the usefulness of the superstitions. The fact is that most sailors do have a set of beliefs about how to have a safe and successful trip, and there's nothing whatsoever that will make a superstitious sailor get on a boat when he or she believes there is danger afoot.
So Beth and I have a late uncle. His name's Adam, and he was a professional fisherman. And Adam, those of you who it later became a movie, but in the book, A Perfect Storm, he is mentioned by name because as they were getting on that boat to go out to sea, he had this feeling that there was danger and it was this awful situation and he knew he was not going to get on. And he said, I believe he said outright, that ship's going to go down. He just had a bad feeling and he wouldn't get on the ship. And that was the ship in Perfect Storm. Tragically, he ended up dying at sea a couple of years later, but that just reminded me of it, about how when they have a bad feeling, they just won't get on the boat.
Right. Yeah. That boat out of Gloucester that he wouldn't get on that sunk in the perfect storm was the Andrea Gale. And then he ended up actually being lost off of North Carolina a couple of years later on the Tiffany Vance, I believe. But yeah, he said to Uncle Jeff, because Uncle Jeff was the one who drove him up to the Andrea Gale in Gloucester, that's who he said that boat's doomed. I'm not getting on there. And yeah, it's crazy. So yeah, superstitious fishermen, like they know what they're talking about. Also, interestingly enough, I don't know if you ever talked to Bruce and Cynthia about this, but when the kids were all young, when our aunts and uncles were all young, Bruce and Cynthia got into this thing where they would try to ask the kids like what they had done in their previous lives, because they believed that there's a certain window of time in a young child's life where they still remember their previous life, but they now have enough language skills in this life that they can tell you what happened. And so they said that when they had been asking Adam about it when he was a young child, that he had basically told them that in his previous life, he had been a fisherman. You know, because they had him describe, you know, like the things that he could see and different experiences that he was having, that he had had. So, yeah. So it was no surprise to them when he decided to be a fisherman as he got a little bit older. And they were like, there was nothing we could have done to dissuade him. That was just Adam's soul was meant to be a fisherman.
Wow.
So isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. That's a cool story. I wonder what everyone else had.
So, all right. So with all of that superstition talk in mind, let's talk about the good ship Charles Haskell. All right. Also, can I just mention it's weird that the ship has a man's name, Charles Haskell?
I thought so too. Maybe it was either named after someone or they were just trying to be like funny. Like, you know, when people name their cats like George?
Maybe.
Kevin the cat.
But I mean, boats are typically named after women. Or they have a punny take on boating, you know, like our other cousin that I sail with has a boat called Tub Toy. It's a huge boat. and so, yeah, but it's just a Tub Toy. It's stuff like that. You don't often find ships named after men. Just saying.
Yeah.
All right. So the Haskell was built in 1869 in a little fishing town here in Massachusetts called Gloucester. During construction of the ship, one of the workers died. Now, when I talk about the superstitions of the sailors, no one seemed to mention the superstition of if someone dies in the construction of the ship, it's clearly a doomed ship. But if you can believe it, many sailors would take that death as a bad omen. So it took months before the owner of the ship was able to find a captain to sail the Haskell. Ultimately, he found Captain Clifford Curtis of Gloucester, and Captain Curtis was hard up enough to take the job as captain. both hard up in that he needed the money from a job and hard up in that he didn't believe the death of the construction worker was a bad omen. He hired a fishing crew of 16 men, and in the early winter of 1869 to 70, they set sail for the fishing area known as George's Bank. And that's an area that stretches from Cape Cod off of Massachusetts to Nova Scotia off of Canada. It's prime cod and halibut fishing grounds. The Haskell had a successful maiden voyage. They fished for several weeks and returned to Gloucester with 7,500 pounds of fish. And any idea that the ship was cursed or doomed was put to rest. They basically unloaded the cargo, took a shower, and headed back to sea. They arrived back at George's Bank for their second run of the season in early March, and the good luck of the first trip quickly wore off. A hurricane set upon them, and Captain Curtis ordered the anchor lines cut so the ship wouldn't be dragged under or hit by another ship in the crashing sea. But when Captain Curtis cut the anchor lines, he left his own ship at the mercy of the wind and waves. The Haskell was tossed about for several hours, and as they crested the top of one particularly large swell, the prow of the Haskell came down on top of the Andrew Johnson, a Salem-based vessel, and pretty much broke the Andrew Johnson in half. The Johnson went down immediately with the entire crew aboard, and it happened so fast there wasn't even a rescue attempt because everybody was just gone.
That's awful.
It really is. Reports vary, but somewhere between 10 and 26 men were aboard the Andrew Johnson, and they all perished. The Haskell, however, miraculously survived and was able to limp back to Gloucester for repairs. It's very rare that a ship would survive such a collision at sea and be able to sail back to port. Typically, both ships would have been damaged so badly that they would both have sank, and most of the crew of both ships would have died. But after some repairs, the Haskell set out for a third trip to George's Bank. So here they arrive back at George's Bank for their third trip. And the first night, the crew of the Haskell were sleeping. The midnight watchman gave a shout. He was scared witless as he watched ghostly hands emerge from the sea and crawl onto the deck of the Haskell. The ghostly apparitions took their positions at different stations among the ship and, now don't laugh, they actually went through the motions of doing their fishing jobs until dawn. They were arranging gear, drawing in nets, cleaning a catch, and all of this went on in front of the horrified crew. When the ghostly visitors put down their jobs at dawn and crawled back into the sea, it shouldn't be a surprise that the Haskell pulled anchor at dawn and set sail back for Gloucester. They were more than a day's sail from land, and even though they sailed all day and into the night, they still weren't close. Around midnight that night, the entire crew waited on deck with bated breath. The ghostly visitors again crawled out of the sea and took their positions around the fishing boat, where they worked all night hauling their invisible catch. But as dawn broke this time, land was in sight. And instead of slipping off into the ocean and disappearing like the previous morning, the ghostly apparitions slid into the sea and began swimming towards Salem, their port of origin. The Haskell docked in Gloucester later that morning, weeks early and with no cargo to sell. It was never sailed again. After the story from the sailors circulated through town, the owner decided he needed to sell the ship and be rid of it forever. But there were no takers. There are a couple of accounts of what happened to the Haskell. The ship never sailed again. But what happened to the physical boat? This is a bit of a mystery as well. You would think there would have been records of a sale or a disposal of some sort, but no one knows exactly what happened to the ship. Some stories have it being bought by a Canadian company and towed away to use as a sand freighter. Other stories talk about it being left to rot at the wharf, where it eventually collapsed into the sea. So whatever happened to the ship itself, one thing is for sure. The ghostly sailors of the Andrew Johnson were never seen again after swimming for Salem. So it's kind of a weird story. And I have two thoughts that come immediately off the top of my head. The first is that given how unusual it is to have ships named after men, what are the chances that there are two ships named after two men that collided in a deadly accident? You know,
yeah, that's weird.
If women are supposed to be bad luck, it seems like men are the bad luck, right? And also, I couldn't find any history behind the Andrew Johnson itself, because it seems like that's the ship that really got the bad end of what was going on there. Like, the ship sank and all the people died. And they came back as ghosts. Like, How did all of that happen? You know, how did that ship end up where it was? Who were those sailors that were on it? Why would they have come back and haunted? I mean, obviously they came back to the Haskell just to hitch a ride back to shore, if you will. And then they went ashore. But I'd be curious if any of those spirits, you know, were still haunting the Salem area.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like this story had a lot of questions left to it.
It's a good story.
Yeah. And you know me, I love boats. Next. Would you like to talk about a little cryptozoology?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Did you know that Gloucester has its own sea serpent?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So August 6th, 1817, two women are walking along Gloucester Harbor and they see a large serpent rise from the water and then disappear just as quickly beneath the surface. The woman stared, stunned, at the water where the wake of a large something was spreading out from the spot they had just seen. And then they told people, right? Because who wouldn't? As you can very well imagine, no one was taking them seriously. They were mocked and ridiculed by their friends and neighbors. But slowly, other people started coming forward with their own accounts of having seen a mysterious creature in the water. And we aren't talking about two or three other people, but dozens of people. The creature was described in general as being dark brown or black in color, 70 to 100 feet long, and as thick as a barrel. What does that even mean? How thick is a barrel?
Thick, real thick.
Yeah? Like, are we talking like a barrel that like people would have gone over Niagara Falls in?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I think so.
Okay.
Like a big water barrel.
Hmm. I would have just liked a little bit clear, like it says 70 to 100 feet long. Like I would have liked, you know, it had a diameter of, you know, 4 feet or whatever, you know. Okay. It had a flat head that would rest about a foot above the water while the creature looked around. It had a long tongue and bright eyes and could hold its breath underwater, swim almost 15 miles an hour, and liked to swim around boats. It was generally like a pretty cool serpent, right? And then other stories started to come to light. For example, in 1638, there was tell of an English sailing vessel in the area who had seen a giant serpent. The crew wanted to spear the serpent, but some merchants who were along for the trip suggested it would be a bad idea. Given the size of the creature, they would have to kill it cleanly with the first shot, because if they only wounded it, the creature was likely to sink the boat as it thrashed about in rage. There were more current reports coming from clam diggers who had been disturbed by a frighteningly large snake that came out of the ocean and was writhing around the banks one afternoon. Terrified clam diggers and beachgoers alike saw the creature. There were official investigations launched by the Linnean Society of New England. Now, do you know what it means to be a Linnean Society?
No.
I didn't either. So naturally, I looked this one up. So this is named after Carl Linnaeus, who was the founder of taxonomy, or the naming of living things.
Whoa.
So not taxidermy, but taxonomy. So back in the 1800s, apparently it was a cool thing because there were all these new things being discovered, but there were societies that got together in order to discover things and then give them their names. Right? On August 14th, 1817, 8 days after the women originally spotted the creature in the sea and started talking about it, there were a record number of sightings of the creature. Over 24 people in boats and on the shore saw the creature, and one boater, a certain Matthew Gaffney, took a shot at the creature and thought he'd hit it. No such luck. The serpent reared up over his boat, went under, and then surfaced about 300 yards away. Mm-hmm. So it got away. But the next month, so now we're talking September 1817, a boy was walking along the beach where he found the body of a bizarre-looking snake. It was black, about 3 feet long, and had weird lumps all over its body. The snake was packaged up and sent to the Linnean Society, where they rushed to name it and publish a paper about it. But it was all for naught. Upon further investigation, the specimen was a common snake that just had some weird lumps. The Linnean Society disbanded soon after this embarrassing incident. So yeah, I mean, like they like full on, they named it and it has some Latin name and I am no good at Latin. And then there were papers published, like they were doing like the tour circuit. Like it was like a crazy circus. And then come to find out, like, no, you just have a deformed snake. Like
a water snake.
All right. That wasn't the last that was heard of the mysterious serpent. There have been sightings of the serpent sporadically over the years in a wide swath of seaside towns on the North Shore. The last sighting in Gloucester was in July of 1960. There have been no reports of the serpent since then. Among the ideas about why the serpent hasn't been seen for over 60 years, it was old and it died. It moved further out to sea due to overfishing along the coast, or it's still around and just waiting to pop its head and weird body above the water sometime soon.
Let's go look.
I had no idea that we had our own Loch Ness monster here in Massachusetts.
I had no idea.
Yeah, that's great. So yeah, this was kind of a fun one. I actually got the idea about this one from Haunted Boston by Taryn Plum. She talks about it in one of her early chapters. And by early, I mean, you know, the ones at the end of the book. And it's called Gloucester's Mystery Guest. So it's just a cute little story. And then when I did a little bit more research on it, there were more stories about it out there in the ether. So that was kind of neat.
That is neat. I'm trying to think about, like, and I can't, like, what could it be? Because, you know, that's like still long enough ago that it could be some weird sea creature we just hadn't identified yet. But okay. I can't think of a single thing that could be.
I mean, is it like a giant mutant eel?
That crossed my mind, but that would be huge for an eel.
Right. And it said
and
that it
why would an eel
breath?
Be like that high up in the ocean? Like, well, they don't come to the surface a lot and like stick their heads out.
Right. And they don't like roll around and like have a good time on the sand.
No.
I was actually wondering, was it a dolphin? Because the idea that like this serpent needs to breathe air, you know, so it has to keep coming back up to the surface, you know, and I just don't know. Did people, was it like a black dolphin and it just looked funny?
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like there are enough dolphins around here where they would know. Yeah, I mean, I've seen dolphins a handful of times out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was described by some people as like an anaconda. It was like, it was clearly.
And dolphins aren't that long.
I know, but it was just the idea of like how fast it could swim and holding its breath and that it was playful. And I'm like, you know, everything except like the weird long tongue and the length of the thing sounds pretty dolphin-like.
Mm.
So I don't know. It's just I had never heard of this before. So I mean,
let's go look.
I think that most of the stuff that we talk about, we've at least like sort of at one point or another heard a little something about it, right? Especially something like if there was a Loch Ness monster off of Massachusetts, how come no one's talking about this?
Mm.
I think we need to drum up some more interest in the Gloucester monster.
I agree.
How should we say that so it rhymes?
Gloucester monster.
Gloucester monster. Oh, yeah, it's the end sound in there that's screwing me up. All right. Anyway, okay. You want to get back to a ghost?
Yeah.
All right. This is my last story for this week. And we are going to talk about the Hammond Castle in Gloucester. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me tell you some more about it then.
Okay.
The castle was built in 1929 for John Hayes Hammond Jr., who was an aspiring scientist and early remote control technology pioneer. Construction on the massive stone structure began in 1926, and it was designed in several different architectural styles, medieval, Romanesque, French Renaissance, and even Gothic. So apparently when you go to this castle thing, as you look at different parts of it, it has different architecture styles, which is interesting cool. in and of itself.
Yeah, that's real cool.
It includes some really neat features like secret passages and even devices that make it rain in certain rooms. And so Hammond, because he worked with remote control, like radio wave stuff, he would like push buttons on his remote control and make it rain in a room where there were people in there. Like,
whoa.
Because he just was the kind of guy that would do stuff like that. Right. Like imagine a room that would randomly rain. Right. All right.
Well, thinking of that, like what kind of floor drains do you have to install in a room?
I don't know.
You'd have to like curve the floor certain ways when you have it built. But I guess if he had it built.
Yeah.
No, I just want that much money. That's all I'm asking. I just want enough money. I can just do whatever I want.
I just want enough money that I can build myself some weird medieval-esque castle.
And you know what? If I built a castle, I would use all those different types of styles. Like, I would think it was great.
Sure. During construction of the home, one of the landscapers died. And we all know what a great situation it is when a construction worker dies during building of anything, right? So a little about Mr. Hammond himself. He was born in San Francisco and he moved around a lot. By the age of 12, he was living in England and he became enamored with castles of all types. He loved architecture. He moved back to the U.S. in his late teens and he met a guy named Thomas Edison. Edison served as a mentor to the young man and helped ignite a passion within Hammond for science, and specifically the new and little understood science of radio waves. Hammond found himself a new mentor, another guy you may have heard of, Alexander Graham Bell. He got a job at the U.S. Patent Office and studied all things to do with patents. He ended up inventing and patenting hundreds of things over the years. I saw reports that he had upward of 800 items that he had invented and patented. John and his wife, Irene, lived in the castle for many years. They would invite friends and hold seances in the home. In fact, he had a chair that he referred to as the dead spot where he sat for all the seances. And there's even a whisper room where people claim to have heard the voices of disembodied spirits. The Hammonds were interested in all sorts of paranormal stuff, and he invented and tried out many devices in attempts to connect with the spirits. He was obsessed with collecting historical artifacts from the ancient world, like Greece, Rome, and Mesopotamia. He also loved medieval artifacts, and even, you know, like Renaissance and early modern history artifacts. He claimed he felt connected to the previous owners and artisans who had created the items. One of his famed possessions that's absolutely disturbing is he actually had, and you can still go see this, the skull of one of Christopher Columbus's crew members.
Whoa.
In 1965, Hammond died. He was buried on the property. And this is wild. You'll love this. In his final wishes, he asked to be buried with his late and obviously beloved cat, and he wanted their grave to be covered in poison ivy. Why? So no one would bother him after his death, of course. It's so sweet or creepy.
I like that a lot.
That he wanted to be alone and undisturbed with his cat for all time. So apparently he and his wife were just crazy about cats. They had lots of them. They would do these long and intricate burial rituals for the cats when they died. And they were buried all over the property. Very, very strange. Hammond himself many, many times had said that he wanted to be reincarnated as a cat. We have all the ingredients for a ghost story, right? We have a construction worker that died on the site. We have some eccentric guy living there, creating all these scientific contraptions to contact the dead, holding seances. It's a big stone building, right? So we talk about some of the hauntings?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So our landscaper, who died during construction, has been seen by many visitors to the castle. He's often seen walking around looking like he's trying to tend to the gardens that he used to tend. He's seen over in the tool shed, checking on all the tools, making sure that they're all in order. And so it's just like a labor of love that just kind of hangs around there, right? All right. There are a bunch of unrecognized spirits in the castle, so we don't know exactly who these spirits are, but there are ghosts that have been captured in visitors' photographs and videos. A visitor named Linda reports that when she visited last summer, she went into the rooms and became violently ill. Her phone was buzzing continually in her pocket, even though it was turned off.
Mm.
Right. So I'm not sure how that works. Once she left the building, however, she immediately felt fine and her phone returned to normal. Wedding guests in the castle have seen a red-haired woman who appears suddenly and then disappears just as quickly. Ghost hunters in the castle have recorded EVPs of cats meowing and a woman's voice trying to say something beginning with p, 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 like she couldn't get it out. She just kept going p, p, p.
I'm really disappointed because you asked me if I had heard of this place and I said, yes, I had, but I had not known it was haunted.
Oh,
I had known about it because I considered it for a wedding venue.
Ah, okay.
And now that I know how haunted it is, I'm kind of like, dang it.
Well, you should see if it's available.
I know. Some newspaper around here had a thing where it's like, it's really good for like your micro wedding during the COVID.
Did I already talk about, so John Hayes talked about being reincarnated as a cat, right? And so after his death, all of a sudden, this black cat just shows up at the castle and just hangs around there and continually just keeps going to his dead spot chair and just sitting in the chair.
Cool.
Just, and so this cat just, people were wondering, is it the reincarnation of John Hammond himself? But
probably.
Maybe, but who knows? It's not like the cat can talk. So I would think if you came back reincarnated, like, please come back in as something that can communicate, right? Like, wouldn't it be cool to come back as like Siri, and then you could actually tell people?
That's scary.
All right. And there have also been sightings of Irene Hammond, John's wife, wandering around the castle. She does that, you know, lost lady thing where she looks out the windows at the ocean and sighs and then disappears. So that's kind of neat. All right. So the Hasselkammon.
The what?
I know. I'm going to say that again.
The what?
The Hammond Castle is open for self-guided tours, weddings, and all sorts of events. Every Halloween, they have a spectacular offering of festivities for all ages, and you should bring the family. You can visit them at the Hammond Castle Museum, which is at 80 Hesperus Ave in Gloucester. They are currently closed, but opening day for the year is April 2nd, and you can reserve tickets online. They're going to have timed entry to allow for COVID-19 safety protocols. Adults are $18, seniors are $15, children 5 to 12 years old are $10, and under 5 are free. So, Amelia, we definitely need to go here.
I'll go there.
Yeah. It's good. I would pay $18 to go walk around and look at all the stuff.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And besides, if you get it for your wedding venue, maybe a ghost will show up in your wedding pictures.
God, that'd be great.
All right. So those are my stories.
Woohoo, good stories.
Yeah. I was especially intrigued by the idea of the serpent.
Yeah.
I liked that one.
Haunted Gloucester.
Yeah. So if you're in the New England area and you're looking for, you know, a fun place to go, try out Gloucester.
Try out Gloucester. Yeah. They have lots of good whale watches. You know me, I like a good whale watch.
Yeah. You'll go on a whale watch? They're on the ocean.
Yeah, I love whale watches. I want a big whale watch this year. I love whale watches. But I call ahead to make sure, because like some whale watches you go on, they have like, you know, the cabin where you get the snacks, and sometimes they have clam chowder, and I can't have that, so I don't go on those ones.
Oh, okay. So anything else going on?
I have a brief correction corner, and it is that one of our listeners, Mike, reached out to the show and corrected me, because I, on our last episode about Eastern European vampires, kept saying the Ukraine, and it is actually just Ukraine. So sorry. And you know, I realize I do that all the time. I always call it the Ukraine. I don't know why.
Okay.
And then I was like, do I do it because it's the United States and it's like you to you? But then I was thinking about it. I never say the Uganda. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm going to be cognizant of moving forward.
All right.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, yeah, thanks, Mike.
We got a 5-star review.
Of course we did.
But this is an extra special 5-star review.
All of our 5-star reviews are extra special. This is just this week's 5-star review.
This one is from the UK.
Title, Little Gem, and then there's even a little gem emoji after it. 5 stars. Stumbled across this, and what a great little find. Wish I had found it sooner. Love, Abby from the UK, and a little British flag.
Ah!
Yay!
Thank you, Abby. Yay!
Thanks, Abby.
That is
We're
very
glad
exciting.
That you found us. Better late than never.
Yay!
Is that it? Is that all of our 5-star reviews this week?
That's it.
People. How many 5-star reviews do we have? Do you know?
In the United States, we have 82.
Just in
general. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. We have 82 reviews. We have 82 reviews. I would say 75 of them are 5 stars.
Okay. So we have 75 of our listeners who have taken the time to go on and give us some sort of review, either the stars or write something. So if you're not one of those 75 or 82 people, maybe this week maybe right now as you're listening, you just take 2 seconds to go and hit the 5-star review for Ghost Hunting in New England. And we would really appreciate it.
5 stars.
And by all means, if you write something, we'll say it on the air and we'll give you a shout out. Any mail?
Nope.
Any letters?
No.
Any drive-by ghostings?
No.
People, the drive-by ghostings. We're seriously lacking in drive-by ghostings this season, I have to say. I'm very disappointed in you all. No, I'm just kidding.
I got, where my grandmother lives in assisted living, so we've been clearing out our house. I got a witch's ball from her, which is kind of cool, right? That's kind of fun. And then I sent you a photo of it. I got this, it's like a little statue figurine of a scarab, and it has hieroglyphics on the back of it. It's from Egypt, probably from Cairo. And I was really into it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And I sent Beth a picture and I was like, oh, it's kind of neat. So I sent a photo of it to David Ray, who's been on the show before. And he's a collector and a numismatist and all sort of stuff. And I was like, hey, like, I'm sure this is nothing, but you know, I just want to check, see what it is. And he sent me back, and it's not haunted, which whatever, but he said it had to do with, oh gosh, I was turning my phone on me. I'd look at exactly what he said, but it had to do with like baking, and it would be like a good like amulet for someone who likes to bake and cook.
Oh, nice.
Which is kind of cool, right?
All right.
Yeah. So I thought that was fun. I thought it was interesting that I ended up with that one.
Yeah. And even more interesting because I'm pretty sure your fiance told you you can't have any more stuff in the kitchen until you move.
It's true. He did tell me that. Yeah.
We're not listening to that, right?
No. He doesn't control the kitchen. I do. When he learns how to cook, he can tell me what to do with our kitchen.
You want to contact info us out?
Sure. You can reach us online at ghosthuntinginnewengland.com, facebook.com/ghostinginnewengland, on Instagram at ghosthuntinginnewengland, on Twitter at ghosthuntingne. Please send us a email at ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. And please leave us a 5-star review. Thank you, as always, to Aaron Shilb. You can find him and his podcast, Nashville Tour Stop, wherever podcasts can be found. And when you're driving on the highway, don't have any loose boxes hanging around. I feel like lately, whenever I'm on the highway, there's like a freaking box jumping off someone's car and it just like crashes. There's never anything in it. It's all these freaking empty boxes. And I'm me and I believe like everything kind of happens. So then I go into this headspace of like, what does it mean that like empty boxes are like flying at the highway on me? I almost got killed today because of one on my way here. And we all had to like stop on the highway.
Because of a box?
Yeah, because you don't know what's in the box when it comes flying off. You don't know.
Could be cement blocks.
Could be anything.
Yeah.
You don't know till it hits the ground.
Could be a body. It could be the start of a ghost.
That's like my biggest thing. Whenever I see like weird stuff on the road, I'm like, oh God, I hope it's not a body.
Whenever I see like a little like paper bag on the side of the road, I'm like, I wonder if it's full of money.
See, I guess you're just much more positive than me because I see stuff like that and I'm like, I bet there's a foot inside. I watch too much Investigation Discovery.
A foot. Yeah. I don't think I've ever considered maybe that there was a foot in one of those.
It happens. People, that's how people dispose of bodies. They cut them all up and they throw them off the side of the road all over the place. So you have a highway, you have like 8 miles of road and you find little pieces of body parts. It happens all the time. Beth, today it happens.
Now that you mention it, I do recall hearing some of that on different true crime shows here and there. Anyway, folks, by all means, do not kill anyone. Do not scatter their body along the highway. Do not put them in a vat of acid. Be good to all of your people. Pat your cat. And as always,
happy hunting.